Grand Canyon University, a Christian university, is one of the largest and fastest growing universities in the country, offering over 200 engaging programs online. GCU integrates the free market system and its welcoming Christian worldview perspective into its academic programs and throughout our online campus. GCU's online students received over $100 million in scholarships in 2020. Visit gcu.edu/myoffer to see the scholarships you qualify for.
You know I'm right. Nick Durst here with Joe Calabrese. And Joe, the Olympics are kicking off here. Things are getting down here to the nitty gritty, a year in the making. And of course, we got to do some Olympic coverage. We've had such great NBC people on with us. And now we're finally going to have somebody who's right there in the midst of things in Japan.
Yeah. First off, it's really nice to have the Olympics come back. Obviously, there's still COVID going on in the world, but for the most part, it seems like everything is going to be okay to start on time and within the next week here. So we're really, really excited. We have a really, really interesting guest on today. Somebody who previously worked in the States, but ended up moving to Japan back in 2006. Previously worked for the Japan Times, currently works for the Japan Forward. And he also has a book, Going 15 Rounds with Jerry Eisenberg, which we were going to talk about very, very soon. Very, very interesting guest. Don't kill me if I slightly mispronounce this, but Ed Odeven. Is that close enough?
Odeven.
Odeven. Okay. You are our guest today. So welcome to New York. You know I'm right. It's not the morning there. It is the night. There is definitely that large time difference. It is 11 o'clock in the morning here. It is midnight there, but thank you for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, guys. It's officially July 17th here already. So we're less than a week now from the opening ceremony of the Tokyo Olympics.
Yeah, and from, you know, you're there. So I want to ask you, you know, what is really going on there? Everything we hear is it's really bad. The COVID cases are on the rise. Obviously they announced no fans in the stands, which is horrible. I don't know how that impacts you and your media brothers and sisters. But how what's the strategy for you here to cover the games with such limited access?
It's a complicated question because the case numbers have never been, you know, the same level as that you saw in Europe, in Italy at the outbreak, or in China, or like in New York last year. It has never been that high. And across the board, 99% of society wears masks. So the spread of the virus is much, much, much lower. But I think they are overcautious in some of their decisions and some of their policies. And the hospital beds, the availability of hospital beds become a big concern. And if cases reach 1,000, for example, in any given day in Tokyo, it really, the panic button gets pushed. They declare what is called a state of emergency, right? But it's really like a quasi state of emergency where things close at 8 o'clock at night, restaurants, bars, department stores. So they're trying to get people out of the city and, you know, stay home. But yeah, as far as having no fans in the stands, well, you know, professional baseball has had fans in the stands for more than a year, professional soccer, professional basketball. What they've done is reduce the attendance to 25 or 50%. And everybody enters has to, you know, have their temperature tested. They have to have a mask on. They have to wash their hands with the liquid alcohol. So there are precautions in place. It's hard to figure out some of the policies, but you got people coming from around the world with the Delta variant really picking up steam, right? Look at it in the States right now. The spread of the variant of the COVID, the mutation of it, and people get really scared. Certain policymakers, the public is not 100% for the Olympics. A lot of people opposed to it, fearing that people will spread the virus within Japan and once they leave Japan, and then they, you know, it's like a bad image of Japan. you're the place the world grew and grew and grew more, you know, like this thing got out of hand because of the Olympics. So it's a very complicated and complex issue. Media coverage, the passes were a lot less passes were issued to media, traditional big companies, and even more upstarts. A lot less passes were given, and a lot more coverage is being done remotely, you know, outside the stadiums, you know, watching on TV, participating in Zoom messages, online calls. So it's not ideal in some ways. We're doing a lot of coverage on the periphery as well. You know, man on the street kind of questionnaires, columns about Japanese sports history, some Olympic greats from any particular event. So it is going to be a challenge. I can't tell you that it's like a normal Olympics.
So you kind of just touched on it a little bit there, but I wanted to ask you specifically, how many direct officials who work directly with the Olympics have you spoken to here, let's say in the last month or so, last couple of months? And what are other contingency plans in place? Because I know a lot of American media journalists who have now flown over there and been there for the last week or so. Are there contingency plans to keep people, let's say, in hotel rooms and continue to use the Zoom calls, as you were saying? Is there any plans directly for the athletes in terms of availability and coverage for you that could help you in any way? And can't speak on other publications in Japan, but do you know of other contingency plans for other publications should the games either be halted in any way, or games or specific events be delayed in any way? Do you know how that's going to work?
Well, there's a lot to unpack there, Joe. Let me begin with a couple of examples personally. I have access to a auxiliary press center, but the main press center, which is called the MPC, and there's the NBC, IBC, International Broadcasting Center. They limited the number of passes this year, and the fact that my company is a startup, only started in 2017. We were at the bottom of the totem pole in terms of getting passes. And before the pandemic, it would have been much more likely to get all access passes. But unfortunately, the number of people getting passes to everywhere inside the stadiums, you know, was cut in probably half. You probably read with some of your work in the New York, New Jersey metropolitan area and Connecticut that a lot of people working as broadcasters or NBC are going to be working remotely from the Stamford, Connecticut headquarters and actually broadcasting, you know, from a live feed, but doing the actual play-by-play, you know, half a world away. But as far as like print media, a lot of the bigger New York Times, LA Times, Washington Post, those people are there. They're at hotels. They're trying to figure out. Sometimes they're hearing back from the Tokyo 2020 organizers or even the press liaisons. They don't respond to emails that quickly. And some of the protocols, like using this app to mark your temperature, using this paperwork to do something else, it isn't streamlined. It's very confusing. And there have been people with questions like, how do I do this or that to follow the rules? So I want to get from step one to step two, get on with my job. We have a summer intern. I'm not going to name names because of maybe privacy in this case, but we had a summer intern who just started a couple recently who had to stay at a hotel for several days before moving back to her family's home in Japan. But she's a college student in the States. So you go from one step to the next like that. Briefly, as far as like in normal circumstances, certain events are considered high profile events, like the men's basketball final, the day of track and field where there's a 100-meter final, and the day of the swimming when like Michael Phelps is going for all those records years ago, where your all access pass is technically available to go everywhere within the Olympic venue complex. But on certain events, there's an overflow of media, and they'll also issue like a lottery pass for that particular event. where each National Olympic Committee will get, based on the population of the country or the size of the Olympic Committee, they'll get a certain number of passes for that event. So when for Team USA at the 2012 Olympics in London, I applied for a pass for the men's basketball final to watch US and Spain. I couldn't get a ticket through the Japanese Olympic Committee, and I contacted FIBA directly themselves. I contacted the PR manager of the, you know, International Basketball Federation, and he gave me one ticket for the game. So it was like the backup plan. You go through the international sports governing body, you know, you can tell them, for example, I cover the World Basketball Championship in Japan. I'm the main beat reporter of the sport here in English. Do you happen to have one pass? You know, if you ask for 10 passes, they'll just laugh at you. But you try to get one, you probably have a decent shot. But this year, I tried through the NBA for the basketball final, the men's final, and they told me they can't help me out. The NBA office in Hong Kong told me, honestly, we can't do it this time. We're restricted big time. I'm trying through FIBA, though. I'm trying once again through FIBA. They said maybe they'll be able to help me out for the basketball finals, including the 3-on-3 finals. So I might actually go to the street ball game for 1 or 2 days. However, it starts like at 10 at night. So I don't know if that's worthwhile, though. It might be better to get a good night's rest and then just bang out a story in the morning. Because the trains are going to be stopping early in some places because of security measures in check, and also
you might get stuck at the venue overnight. Then
that's true.
Yeah, that was.
I don't have a car either, so I've been taking trains for 15 years or taxis. Now the International Surfing Association, we had the president of their of the ISA on a podcast about a month and a half ago, Fernando Aguirre from Argentina, and I contacted their marketing manager. Just like the same thing with FIBA. I said, you think you can help me out with the pass? You know, you're a new sport in the Olympics. We'd like to give you guys a nice showcase. Can I have a day pass for the day of the finals? You know, just the gold medal and the semifinal matches before that, like, you know, the head-to-head surfing. And they just apologized. Sorry, we can't do it. Some of our employees are even working remotely. So individual sports are being cut down, reduced in numbers. And it was only a week ago that the fans were given the shaft completely. That was last Friday. So previously they announced like 3 weeks, 2 weeks before that, maybe up to 10,000 people. 2 weeks later, zero. Now they're saying maybe if the state of emergency ends, Thomas Bach is asking the Prime Minister Suga, oh, can you please open the venues again? Where they're already in the process of canceling, you know, refunding on tickets. So it's pure chaos in that regard.
Yeah, it's going to be tough. And you know, you mentioned all these sports that usually are hot tickets.
Yeah.
There's not that star power this year that you usually see. In tennis, Federer, he's out. There's some golfers pulling out, but really who's going to watch golf in the Olympics anyway, usually. But right. Men's basketball, USA, is not looking good. Losing all these exhibition games. People are getting COVID. They have Kevin Durant. They have Damian Lillard. Beyond that, yeah, They're in trouble. There's no LeBron James. There's no Chris Paul, Carmelo Anthony, Steph Curry. So There's no guarantee there in the gold medal game. Michael Phelps retired. Ryan Lochte, unfortunately, didn't make the Olympics.
Right.
Usually women's gymnastics, there's, you know, everyone's going crazy over Simone Biles. The rest of the team at this point lacks the star power, but you don't know. Like, there's no Ali Raisman there, usually another big time star. No Usain Bolt in running. So beyond that, you'd be hard pressed to find anybody to name another track athlete. So all that considered there, plus the fact that, you know, everything was postponed a year, there's no fans now. Is there still that buzz? Is there still that juice? Or are the people in Japan still really looking forward to the Olympics?
You know, it's probably 50-50. You got people that are looking for distraction from all the COVID news. I mean, it's been going on now for 16, 17 months. And since last March, the whole population has been wearing masks, essentially everybody, wherever you go. And, you know, it gets tiring after a while, doesn't it? Now, certain people love certain sports, and I think they're going to tune into like like with basketball, I was watching the Japan Belgium game earlier tonight a little bit. Rui Hachimura from the Washington Wizards played his first game with the national team in more than 2 years tonight. They had some exhibitions last week that wrapped up down in Okinawa, and Yuta Watanabe of the Toronto Raptors was the captain of that group. He's still the captain, but I mean, he was the clear leader of that team. And two guys that have NBA or NBA G League experience were not there for the first group of exhibition games. And then tonight against Belgium, they jumped out to a 30-11 lead early on, end of the first quarter. Chimura had 24 points tonight, and Udai Baba, who had played for the Texas Legends and then the past season played for Melbourne United in Australia and won a title, he came back and played his first game tonight as well, after they both had a few weeks off after the season, plus protocol, you know, COVID protocol, working out a little bit. But they're now, they have the full 12 players now. So basketball has grown in popularity quite a bit in the last few years. So I think if you're a diehard basketball fan, you're still looking forward to watching Japan in the Olympics, because the last time they were in the Olympics, the men's team, 1976. So unless you're one of the other generation, you're not going to remember that. And born NBA players then from Japan. So this is kind of this is a new thing. And baseball too. Baseball is really loved in Japan. And the NPB, Nippon Professional Baseball, actually played its last game of the regular season before the break on Wednesday. And they have two All-Star games today and tomorrow. And then there's the Olympic break until I forget
you,
the exact.
You have to consider August. Japan the favorites, because they're bringing professional players. USA's got a guy, Todd Frazier, but beyond that, they're not going to be well. But it's great to see baseball and softball back in the Olympics. A disgrace that they ever were gone for two Olympics.
Yeah. So I think that those sports, people like baseball and softball. They like basketball. Swimming and marathon are pretty popular. Judo is a national sport, like sumo. And judo, Japan wins medals. And if Japan doesn't win medals in all but like one or two events of the weight categories, it's like a national disgrace.
Right.
That's how people view it.
How about table tennis and badminton?
They're pretty popular too, yeah. At any time the Japanese beat a Chinese in any of the events, either in a preliminary or a medal event, it's a big deal as well, because China is so good in both of those events.
Right. Now, the conspiracy theory, but it's not really a conspiracy, is that the only reason that the Olympics are actually still taking place is because of three letters, NBC. They're in charge. They're running the show here. Somebody from the IOC or somebody from Japan kind of made some sort of remarks pointing it to that direction. What's your take on that? Because let's remember here, we're only 6 months away after this Olympics from the Winter Games. So NBC, they got rid of NHL. Mm-hmm. All their money is all about the Olympics and NFL. So it would have been a big issue if no Olympics went on. And they're probably not too upset about no fans in the stands, because you would think that would be an extra rating because nobody's traveling there.
Right. Well, ratings for who? Ratings for overseas or ratings within Japan?
Ratings for in the United
Maybe both,
States,
right?
United States, NBC, because nobody's traveling from the America to go to the games. Usually you get a good amount of people. So maybe NBC is banking on extra people watching because sell more advertisements.
I think there's definitely some truth to that, if that's the entire picture. I think there's also some political pressure from Japan to the IOC based on the fact that COVID, originated from China.
Right.
I think, the historic rivalry between Japan and China, you look at how Japan wants to beat China and everything. I think Japan wants to also say, look, we can host the first Olympics during the pandemic, and we can do it safely, and we can do it, in spite of everything. I don't think they want to give China the first chance. And I hear political pundits saying that, and people that are connected to, people that are really involved in these like think tanks and people that really study Japanese politics have said things like that in different ways.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I mean, it's a lot more than we see on the surface here. Hopefully,
but a quick point, Nick and Joe, the contract, you know, the IOC has big insurance, a lot of insurance, sort of the organizers, and if they canceled, they'd get a lot of the money back from the organizers. But the only person that can actually cancel the contract technically is the IOC. They have the final say. Tokyo can say, like, we don't want to do it, or we think we have to cancel it. But the IOC has to give the green light. However tricky that might be legally to understand, for me, it's pretty tricky. But, you know, I think they should have postponed it originally 2 years. I think the actual Olympic calendar, everything should have been pushed back from the summer. Like, instead of Paris being 2024, make it 2026. Make Tokyo 2020, 2022. Because when they announced the decision last March, it was only a week after the postponement was made. And then a week later, they said it's going to be 1 year later to the month. It was only one day off. Last year was going to be July 24th. This year, July 23rd. And when they made the announcement last March, none of the vaccines have been tested yet or even proven that they could be used. I think they were premature to rush the decision, my own belief. Do you guys agree at all? Or,
well, obviously the thing with the Olympics always is that each country is spending billions on infrastructure. So now you're going to have those infrastructures with all these seats, you know, the opening ceremonies, there's going to be nobody there.
Nobody there. Yeah.
I mean, if I'm Japan, I'm in charge of the IFC. I'm looking to give Japan the Olympics in the 2030s, the next available open slot. I think they need to deserve a redo. And maybe they can maintain the infrastructure for 10 years, but a lot of these places, they don't do that. So yeah. I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, if they would have canceled it and then said 2030, I think that's a realistic option. But I don't think they're going to say, okay, you know, it's disappointing you had to do it without fans. We're going to do it again for you. I don't think they would give it to them twice.
It's a big waste of money.
It's very disappointing because
it is.
I know a lot of people who have been to Japan, who have been to Tokyo and a lot of places around there. It's a beautiful country. The people are beautiful, incredibly polite, warm, welcoming. Tokyo itself, naturally, everybody kind of always wants to go there. It feels really off that there are not going to be a lot of people there to take it in, to really capture the moment.
Yeah.
You're going to have to watch it, you know, as best you can on television. And obviously, it's not the same experience.
You know, if they're going to pipe in fan noise, much like the professional leagues did last year.
I think they'll do that in some places, in certain events, but I don't think all events, like when someone's diving or doing a gymnastics, you know, a very complicated maneuver, I think they usually have silence. And then after the performance is done, then they would add the canned cheering.
Yeah.
But I would think with 100 meters of track, they might have music like before the before the gun is shot off.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I would think one of the favorite things for me to watch is always the roar of the crowd at the swimming events. But who knows? You know, I would have been without Michael Phelps anyway. So we'll monitor that. But I really appreciate your insight there on the Olympics. But we want to know more about you here. Oh, you have one more point on the Olympics. Go ahead.
Right. Oh, I just wanted to give a geographical comparison for the listeners and the viewers. You know, Japan, if you take all the islands and combine it into one landmass, it's roughly the size of California. And there are approximately 130 million people here. And there have been about 15,000 deaths nationwide as of this, you know, the time of our recording here. So it's not a microscopic number, but the numbers compared to other countries, like you look at Brazil, you look at India, you look at China, you look at the US, England, Germany have had pretty big numbers. Italy. I think part of it has to do with the immune system and the diet. And diabetes is a real problem, it appears, with COVID, right? And right. like other illnesses that are kind of like, if you get the ill, if you get it and your ability to fight it off, your immune system is bad to begin with, it's to really be a problem. And people have a very long lifespan in Japan and into the 80s, probably one of the top three in the world as of the latest numbers, along with maybe a couple Mediterranean countries. So I think the diet and the active lifestyle have really helped contribute to that. And then the group think about everybody wearing a mask has really contributed to keeping the numbers down. But there have been waves and spikes in the, you know, in the COVID cases. And I think the fact that it's a very congested country, especially in the big metropolitan regions, like the Tokyo metropolis is 30 million people. So if the increase of numbers keep going up, and if they go up exponentially, you really have a problem, right? So in a way, in some cases, I think they're being overcautious, and other times they're probably being smart.
So I think that's a really good point. The underlying issue is more, I think, maybe here in the States and in other places, but that's a really good point about Japan. The health and the safety there, it's definitely on a different level. And you're definitely right about the life expectancy. I don't know what the exact figure is, but Japan does have one of the highest life expectancies in the world. A lot of the sicknesses and illnesses that you see around the world are a little less prevalent in Japan. That's definitely 100% a thing. So definitely contributing.
I think for women, it's 84 is the average, is the life expectancy, which, or 83. And men, I think men, it's like 80. And, you know, that's several years higher than in the States.
Right. Still not too terribly far off, but definitely there's a little bit of a difference there in Japan. But
right.
We do want to take it back to the States. We want to take it back to before you moved out there. You went to Arizona State. And you worked for the Arizona State University State Press and the Daily Sun. So talk about just your younger years in general, maybe high school. When did you know sports writing, reporting is something that you wanted to do? And when did you make that decision that you wanted to go to Arizona State?
Well, after my freshman year in high school in New Jersey, in Rockaway, Morris Hills High School, my mother, stepfather, and brothers and sisters, we moved out to Tucson in Arizona. And so from sophomore year of high school, completed my high school years in Arizona. And junior year of high school, I worked for a local radio station doing phone-in reports of high school football home games on Friday nights this is a long time ago now, I used a payphone to call in the score and call in like a quick highlight. Stats and like three, four of you know, maybe quote the coach and one or two players. And I really got adrenaline rush from jotting down a quick summary of the game. And I thought maybe I want to be a sports announcer and worked for the high school newspaper as a senior in high school. And I found that I liked both writing and reporting, you know, in print. And I went to Pima Community College in Tucson for a few years, worked for the weekly paper there, also the Aztec Press. And three of my buddies and I, we did a public access sports talk show on Friday nights. And we talked about the NFL and the MLB and the Pac-10 football. We did a big NHL preview one year. And so we just took phone calls and did like, kind of like a Wayne's World type of show where really there was no budget and just, you know, we put together highlights ourselves. We didn't have the broadcast rights to do it, but we were like putting together a little table like HBO highlights and saying, hey, this is the NFL from last week. What do you guys think about the next week's games? And that was all before I went to ASU, Arizona State University. And so I transferred from Pima Community College to ASU and pursued a bachelor's degree in print journalism. And the nice thing about Tempe, where the campus is, you got the airport in Phoenix, and then you got all the spring training sites there. And you've got the NBA, the Suns, the Cardinals were there for a few years. They were awful back in the 90s. And then you had the Coyotes who moved there from Winnipeg right around the time when I started, the year after I started the autumn after the I started in the spring semester, but that fall, the Coyotes had moved there. So it was becoming a really big market for sports. You had all four of the major North American teams by a couple of years later. Then the Diamondbacks joined.
Hear that? That's the sound of someone trying to steal your crypto. Every day, thousands of hackers online are doing the same. That's why Arculus uses air-gapped cold storage technology to protect your assets. Using our keycard and wallet app to form a protective barrier, Arculus insulates you from hackers and puts control of your digital assets back in your hands. Order the first truly air-gapped crypto wallet at getarculus.com.
So from the campus, it's like 15 minutes away by car. You've got the Cardinals, the Diamondbacks, the Suns, and the Coyotes. So it was a good place to be to get training as a young journalist and to try to compete to get good stories and see how bigger media people did it. You know, watch what they did, listen to how they asked questions, go to spring training, try to do freelance work for different media outlets, you know, pitch a story here and there. It was really fun. One of your guests years ago, I work with him. Maybe I'll backtrack to this in a minute, but after college, I did a 6-month internship, postgraduate internship at the Birmingham News in Alabama, statewide newspaper, and covered everything there from arena football to Bo Jackson showing up at the airport to consider buying a spring football league team. The Houston Rockets were there, and Charles Barkley was back in town for an exhibition game. And at halftime of one of the games, of that game, I should say, he walked with his mother in one arm and his grandmother on the other arm. And he stood at halftime at the court and presented a check to three different organizations: Auburn University, his high school, Leeds High School, and a inner city program. $1 million apiece to fund school programs and scholarships. So this is part of the media coverage that I'm getting to do really early in my career, is seeing like how people interact with Bo Jackson at the airport, how he reacted to me wanting to interview him right when he got off the plane. He's like, "No, man, I'm not talking right now. You know, I'll just tell you, you know, I'm not making any decisions today. I'm interested in football. I might buy a team, but no interview today, you know?" And then a couple of weeks later, interviewing Charles Barkley with the big scrum for the game. Those are some really fun assignments in 1999 to 2000, that 6-month period. And the high school football season, I was there for the entire season in Alabama, traveled all over the state, big games, small towns of like 500 people, where the population at the stadium was quadruple that. Sometimes five times that, you know, like 3,000 people, six times that at a game. I went back to Arizona. I worked with Dan Rosen for less than a year, but he was graduated a year after I did from U of A, University of Arizona, when I graduated from the rival ASU. And we were both applying for a job, for actually multiple openings, I should say, at the Herald News in New Jersey. Which was owned by the Record at that time in 2000. And I flew out for an interview and did a trial assignment for the paper, covered a high school basketball game. And they actually paid for my plane ticket.
Wow.
They refunded me for my plane ticket. And I stayed with my father at the time was living in New Jersey still. He just moved to Florida a few months ago, but I had family at East and I stayed with him. It was like a 1-week vacation other than a one-day assignment in January, a freezing cold day, going to a high school basketball game. But it turned out that the paper expanded too early, too many like new hires, and the publisher got mad at the editor, and they're hiring freeze. And then a few months later was 9/11, and it became really difficult to get a job. Mm-hmm. It became an unforeseen future. Like, when are they actually gonna have openings again? So I then moved up to Flagstaff and took a job at the Arizona Daily Sun and worked there for 5 years, moving my way up from reporter to assistant sports editor to sports editor. And it's a small university mountain town up there north of Phoenix, pretty close to the Grand Canyon. You're 7,000 feet above sea level. So it's an Olympic training city where people from all over the world go to Flagstaff, Arizona to train at high altitude, especially sports like swimming, long distance running, triathlon, some of the boating events, rowers, canoers. They see a real benefit in, you know, exerting their lungs at high altitude. And then when they move down to sea level for events, it's so much easier to breathe.
Right, because they're used to the thing there. Yeah, it's Flagstaff's become very popular. I know a very popular show in the States on TLC, Sister Wives, they live there. So yeah, okay. It's becoming a hot spot, but people don't realize about Flagstaff is it's not hot. It's not the dire heat that everyone knows. Right. It gets cold there, right? It's like regular
season. It gets hot, but it gets hot because you're, let's say it was 90 degrees, and you're 7,000 feet above sea level, you're closer to the sun, right? But you don't have the dry, you don't have the dry temperature like in the desert. It's surrounded by the Ponderosa National, the Coconino National Forest. But yeah, the temperature drops like 40 degrees at night.
Yeah.
And wow. You get a lot of snow in the winter. And sometimes up until May, you get snow.
Right.
It's kind of like Denver, or you think of Colorado Springs, where it's, you know, it's quite high up in the mountains.
Right.
Beautiful city. The Cardinals had training camp there for years, and the NFL has done a lot of streamlining of a lot of teams where they train in the same city where they hold their you know, their main stadium or close by. But it's good to get out of town, I think, for the teams, and they can bond a little bit, get out of the heat.
Yeah. Get
out the distractions of their everyday normal routine.
Yeah, team bonding, crucial. Now, how did you ultimately end up making the move, life-changing move, to Japan, joining the Japan Times? How did that opportunity come about for you, and any hesitations for you to move there, and how much Japanese did you know when you first got there, and how good is your Japanese today, you know, 14 years later?
I'll backtrack a little bit here to give you a succinct story. A friend of mine from community college worked as a photographer at a Japanese English newspaper in California the season that Hideo Nomo made his debut from Japan, moved to the States in 1995. That summer, my friend Sachiko worked for the paper and did a lot of baseball photography at Dodger Stadium. And when I moved to Arizona State the next year, she then ultimately got a job as a graphic designer and part photographer at that newspaper in LA. And they were looking for correspondents to help out during spring training to write a little bit about baseball with guys like, you remember Hasegawa, who pitched many years in the majors? Shigetoshi Hasegawa?
Yep.
And I started doing freelance of baseball during spring training, and it evolved to other sports, basketball, gymnastics, a little bit swimming over the years. And I had a pretty big portfolio for about 10 years of spring training coverage, especially baseball. But even then, during the season began, sometimes I would go to Phoenix and do a story on Ichiro, or, you know, when interleague play was going on, I would do a story about Kazuhiro Sasaki or Masato Yoshi. And the year that I was in Alabama, between jobs, I went to spring training throughout Florida. And I watched Hideo Nomo pitch. I watched Hideki Irabu. And I just had a lot of stories in my portfolio. And I like traveling. I like doing stuff maybe that is different and trying to challenge myself. And I enjoyed learning about the culture and meeting people, traveling. And back in 2005, the year before I got hired by the Japan Times, the Associated Press Editors job board, APSC website, listed a job for a baseball writer that had an opening at the Japan Times. I thought, I've got more of a background in baseball coverage than basketball. I've done a lot of basketball, but I thought this would be a cool job, you know, to Tokyo, cover baseball, be an editor part-time.
Right.
So I applied and I became a finalist for the position, but the editor wound up choosing somebody else. Okay, I thought, at least the guy responded to my package and said I had good clips. He said I was like number three on the list of 40 plus people who were considered, you know, candidates. He threw a few of the resumes out. I thought, okay, that's not a bad, that's an encouraging sign. I mean, job market was pretty crazy then. It's up and down ever since. A lot of jobs have gone away, I know. And then a lot of new companies have started, but you don't have as many newspapers as you did 15, 20 years ago. And you don't have as many websites as you did, right? Like a lot of Fox Sports ultimately got rid of a lot of their writers and like went with video. Bleacher Report like got rid of Howard Beck, for example, you know, big time names. I'm not on that level, I don't believe. I like strive for that every day, but I mean, a lot of jobs were downsized. And so what the Japan Times offered me a really interesting, exciting opportunity to move to Japan in 2006. I should say I applied again. They had a job listing again the next year. And a new pro basketball league started in 2005 called the Basketball Japan League. And in 2006, the league was clearly going to be growing and adding new teams and adding good players, good coaches. At that time, Bill Bryant was a head coach, Kobe's father. A lot of former U.S. college players were coming here. And the World Basketball Championship, now it's called the World Cup, the World Cup. But that was being held in Japan that summer. And the Japan Times wanted someone to be their lead basketball writer. And so I actually was hired for that position. And It was a great experience to be in Hiroshima for 8 days during the full group of Japan's preliminary round. I saw such a range of talent and teams. I saw Angola, New Zealand, Germany, Spain, and some great teams just in the opening few, just some really different, interesting teams. And some of the players on the Japan national team, they're still professionally playing and they're really, really good. Some of them are just at the end of their careers. Others of them are still very consistent. But I really didn't speak any Japanese when I moved here. I tried practicing the shorthand writing. I have gotten a lot better at the sound-driven characters. There isn't per se an alphabet like A, B, C, D, 26 letters. There are 46 recognized sound combinations that are normally used, such as ka, ki, ku, ke, ko, sa, shi, su, se, so. And these are written by a shorthand developed by monks, Buddhist monks, many, many hundreds of years ago. But if you see Chinese characters that are on like hip hop design clothes, or if you see like a Japanese movie with the really intricate writing, that's kanji, which was adapted from the way the Chinese wrote. And there are more than 2,000 or 3,000 that are used in general practice. Like the symbol for fire is one kanji. The symbol for water is one. You get a name like Suzuki, and it's essentially three sound combinations. And then there's one kanji which represents sea bass. Like Suzuki means bass. So like each type of fish. So like each type of fish would be one kanji, or some of them are multiple, like 2 + 2. There's like a very different design. I've tried to focus on listening and reading and speaking a lot more than writing, because the writing is really, really difficult, and the number of hours in the day that I have to consume news and to be a journalist really takes up a lot of time. So I moved here on July 4th, 2006. And 2 days later, I started my job. So I didn't have time to go to a school to really immerse myself. I wish I could have done that before I started work, but the timing of work and then the world championship was a month, 7 weeks later. So I had a real crash course in just adjusting to going to the office, trying to get the rudimentary stuff done of using the train, you know, shopping, doing the things, opening a bank account, the things you have to do just to live. I picked up a lot of language from restaurants, cafes, bars, hanging out with friends, going to a sporting event. Words are used like during a baseball game. You know, the words are really similar for sports. Oftentimes, like instead of just saying strikeout, you would hear like more of a with Japanese sounds like strike outo. But then the grammar would be different. The grammar before and after would be different, but you learn how the word is used in the context. And you learn how to speak politely, both in email, I should say written Japanese, like to request an interview or to order something like a new lamp or a mattress. You learn how to deal with those things, you know, just in time with practice.
COVID-19 is still around, but that doesn't mean the Army ROTC programs are not there for you. Earn scholarships for school and pursue the career you want. The leadership-developing Army ROTC classes will give any full-time student the focus and resources that can open doors down the road. Start sharpening the skills that will carve out your future today. Learn how at goarmy.com/ROTC. Army ROTC, now accepting college scholarship applications. Visit goarmy.com/moneyforcollege.
I can certainly get better, but I'm intermediate level after all these years. I like to be more advanced.
No, it's all interesting. Really, 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 really great stuff. Thanks for sharing a little Japanese. The extent of my Japanese is just konnichiwa. So
you know arigato?
I do not.
That's thank you.
Oh, well, thank you. Much appreciated.
One thing you might find wild and just insane that I tried to describe Japanese basketball to some people around the world, including agents or people who have worked in other countries as coaches, that the Basketball Japan League in 2005 had six teams in the first season, and they expanded nonstop for 11 straight seasons, adding new teams. And by the 11th season, there were 24 teams. And FIBA forced a merger with the JBL, Japan Basketball League, which became the NBL. It was a company league of like Toyota, Toshiba, Mitsubishi. And they forced a merger and a new hierarchical structure like English soccer of tier one, tier two, tier three. And there are more than 40 teams that are professional teams now that are all under the same umbrella. And that started in 2016. But it has really revitalized the sport here because there's a clear path to reach the top, where before it was completely disorganized and you know where the home venues were if you're a casual fan. There was no real organization. It was just sort of organized chaos. But baseball has had 12 teams for more than 70 years. The pro baseball structure has been Central League, six teams, Pacific League, six teams. So the talent pool for baseball is incredible because you don't have a minor league structure like in the States where there are, and even now it's, I know it's changing now where they got rid of the
a lot of teams. Yeah.
Yeah. But you know, Pacific League before International League, and there was the American Association before that. But in Japan, there's only one level of minor league. And then they have industrial leagues. Like Japan Railways has a really good baseball team, and like other companies that players might get picked up. Like let's say the guy's an engineer and plays baseball on the weekends, or he's a lawyer, but he plays baseball. That's another path. It's a long shot path, but you can get scouted that way. If you don't get drafted, you can play for an industrial league team. I think it's sort of like with before the CBA, even there was like the Eastern League. There were some other really small basketball leagues, like when the NBA was just starting out, and you know, players played for AAU teams, you know, way back when.
No, it's all very, very intriguing, interesting stuff. Really, really great tidbits. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So we're going to start to let you go here, but I want to talk about the book before we let you go. Okay. Because you released an ebook last year. There you go.
There it is, guys.
With Jerry Eisenberg. Awesome cover. There you go. Nice little look. So for our viewers and our listeners who don't know, who aren't aware, Jerry Eisenberg is one of the most well-known sports journalists, columnists, probably we'll say of the 20th century. Worked at the Star Ledger. Obviously, people who are paying attention can make the connection. You grew up in this area. Obviously, Nick and I are from this area as well, the New York metropolitan area. So that's where your fascination with him started. So yeah, I do not want to give away too much in the book. Now, we exchanged emails about this.
Yeah.
Some of the more predominant points in the book, I think some of the overarching points are how Jerry's, the journalism, his columns, he was a very important, would not say political figure, but a lot of his work was centered around a lot of political issues that were going on in this country during the time that he was writing when he was younger. Now, you have tremendous stories in the book. I mentioned this in the email about people like Nelson Mandela, people like Fidel Castro, and now everything that's going on with Cuba. You know, he's coming back into the news a little bit. But there's also amazing, amazing chapters about Muhammad Ali and the friendship that Jerry and Muhammad Ali shared. And obviously anybody who knows anything about Muhammad Ali knows he refused to go to the Vietnam War. So again, do not want to share too much about the book, but a lot of it is just really great political commentary told through your words, through Jerry's words. So I got two questions for you. Number one, obviously you kind of knew what you were going to get yourself into. So did you understand really the scope of his political commentary at the time? And did you realize how important a lot of his articles and a lot of his work was through the years? And my second question, you interviewed a lot of sports writers. I don't want to talk about all the sports writers that you interviewed because there's a significant amount of really great writers you got interviews for the book who respect Jerry's career. So who in particular was somebody that stood out that you really enjoyed interview, that you got to meet to do the research for the book?
First point, I knew Jerry had a political mind. His heartbeat is connected to politics, where he views a column as a way to take a stand, to raise issues, to make people think about things, you know, to fight for the underdog, to fight for causes, to, you know, to use the column to point out injustices and racism and, you know, things like that. But I knew that he was a funny guy and he was a conscientious guy, and he just, any topic under the sun interested him. And I think by researching him and asking him questions, I learned a bit more of the full scope of that on how he viewed Muhammad Ali, you know, back in 1960, 1970, 1980, up until the time of his death. I think I got a bit more of a nuanced picture by asking him a bit more about, like, what was it like to observe Muhammad Ali at the opening ceremony of the Olympics, 1996 in Atlanta, because Jerry was there. The next day, I'm not going to give away the story, I'm going to let people read that, but Jerry visited Muhammad Ali the next day, along with Dave Kindred, who is a very prominent sports writer as well. They had a very special gathering with Muhammad Ali the next day, and they talked about the opening ceremony. So Jerry really observed Ali for the entire range of his public life, from the time he was a aspiring gold medalist in the Olympic Village in 1960, before he won the light heavyweight title, until, you know, he passed away. The last couple of years, they didn't speak because, you know, he really couldn't talk. he might comprehend what's said, but he spoke so quietly. You really have to understand, unless you're right there and he's whispering, for example, maybe his wife would repeat what he said. But even at the end, toward the end, you know, George Foreman actually, you know, did FaceTime with Muhammad Ali up until a few months before he passed away. So even if he was just smiling or joking around or maybe doing a card trick, this is something that Muhammad Ali enjoyed. But as far as Jerry, the book was a fascinating journey for me to learn more about his career and really see what was behind his books and his columns and the respect that people that are in the inner circle of you know, sports media really appreciated and respected about him. And I tried to approach the book where I wouldn't be like making a facsimile or a clone of one of his books, but more of a reminiscence from him about what he's done. And maybe he's telling some of the same tales he's told before, but how does he see them differently in his late 80s? Most of the interviews were done between age 86 and 88 for the book. So when the book was published, he had just turned 90 last fall. And so when he's looking back on his life and is, you know, close to age 90, the answers that he's going to give are different than when he's 45 or 35. So I tried to give an old man's look back on what he has seen. And like, you know, like even with some of the stuff, I purposely use like some of the snippets of columns, like, you know, he's writing about Donald Trump and the USFL back in the early 80s. And he's writing about this, you know, again, in the 2020, he's talking about the, you know, his belief that people should be allowed to, you know, kneel during the national anthem. And this is a guy who is a Korean War soldier who is taking this stance. So not all veterans are going to feel the same way. Some will feel offended, but, you know, he believes in the free speech, and this is what he wanted to say. I thought it was important to, you know, to quote him on it. You asked me about special interviews for the book. There were a few that really stood out to me based on their prominence and just their funniness with their wordplay and how they told stories. Wally Matthews is a storyteller. He was a great interview, and he really admires Jerry. Probably the longest chapter in part two of the book actually is from Wally Matthews. Because we spoke like 90 minutes. It was great. John Shulian and Dave Anderson were great, and Ira Burkow were great also. Jeremy Schapp, he spoke about his father and about his father viewed Jerry and about how he viewed Jerry. It was on multiple layers, I thought, that really kind of showcased how they respected Jerry, how he was part of the Red Smith generation, or the next generation, but how he worked with Red Smith and worked with Jim Murray and those guys, and how he carried the torch after they, you know, departed.
Go Water the Going 15 Rounds with Jerry Eisenberg. It's a terrific book. You did an exceptional job with it. You definitely captured that old man looking back on his career. Definitely got some scenes like the end of The Godfather 3. Anyway, Ed, thank you. Thank you for joining us. We know it was a night there, so... we kept you a little late, but we really appreciate you coming on with us, talking to the Olympics, talking to your career, talking about the book. What we do here is we always give our guests the last word. So if there's anything else you would like to share, if there's anything else you would like to promote, go right ahead. The floor is yours. Thank you again for doing this. This is a terrific interview.
The Japan Forward is a very new website established in 2017, and we're very slowly building up the sports section, adding new features, adding new contributors, japan-forward.com. I hope people will check out some of our original reporting on the Olympics. And if you could put the link to the Amazon page for the book when you tweet out the interview, please do so. And I'm curious maybe what people think about the book, or even if you had a favorite story or favorite section of the book, maybe you can share that with your listeners and, you know, engage them. Like, I thought this was funny, or this is interesting, or, you know, like Jerry Brown, I forgot to mention him. Jerry Brown had been to every Super Bowl, including this year's, in person. Him and Jerry Eisenberg were the first, the last two guys, the only two guys who had gone to the 53 first Super Bowls.
Yep.
As columnists. Yes. 2 years ago, Jerry had to watch remotely. He's having trouble walking, and the demands of going to the press, like the press bus and all those long lines and everything, getting up and down the stadium, it's a bit much for him now. So he watched the last year's Super Bowl at home, and I'm sorry, at a sports book in Las Vegas. This year he watched it at home. But Jerry Brown had some great stories too. I hope people, sorry, I'm a bit long-winded here. I hope people just enjoy learning about Jerry. I try to write the book in sort of a anecdotal biography style, I think, and hopefully the chapters breeze on by.
All right, Ed, we appreciate it. Everyone go check out the book, and best of luck covering the Olympics here in the next 2 weeks. So that's going to do it here for this episode of You Know I'm Right. For our special guest, Ed, for my co-host, Joe, I am Nick, and this has been You Know I'm Right.
Hear that? That's the sound of someone trying to steal your crypto. Every day, thousands of hackers online are doing the same. That's why Arculus uses air-gapped cold storage technology to protect your assets. Using our keycard and wallet app to form a protective barrier, Arculus insulates you from hackers and puts control of your digital assets back in your hands. Order the first truly air-gapped crypto wallet at getarculus.com.